Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Janice Cook Newman is a novelist and instructor at the Book Passage Travel Writers and Photographers Conference in Corte Madera, California. Come along and join Laurie McCandish King, associate producer for the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show, Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, as she talks with Janice about her new book, A Master Plan for Rescue. Janice tells us how she handles the marriage of fact and fiction in historical fiction, just what it's like writing from the point of view of characters very different from herself, and what's new in book promotion and the techniques she's discovered to supercharge her writing. We'll also hear about Lit Camp and the Basement Reading Series, which Janice founded to help create community for emerging writers. Come along and join Laurie McCandish King and Janice Cook Newman.
This is Laurie McCandish King reporting from Corte Madera, California. I'm at the Book Passage Travel Writers Conference, and I'm talking with one of the instructors, Janice Cook Newman, about her new book, A Master Plan for Rescue. Hi, Janice. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about this one.
It's a historical novel. It takes place mostly during World War II. And it's the story of a young boy, 12-year-old Jack, who meets a young man, and both of them, through love and grief, attempt an improbable rescue. The story has actually four first-person point of view characters. But
oh,
it's,
my gosh, that's really complicated.
Yes.
Wow. Well,
it was a seven-year project writing this book. But mostly we have the points of view of Jack, this 12-year-old boy who has lost the most important person in the world to him. He's an Irish boy living in the northern tip of Manhattan during World War II. And Jacob, who is a young Jewish man, we have some of his story when he's in Berlin as Hitler's coming to power, and his part is a love story. But by the time he comes to New York, he's alone, he's grieving, and that's when he meets Jack. And one of the inspirations for this is the story of the St. Louis, which hardly anyone knows, which was a pleasure boat that left Hamburg, Germany in 1939 with 900 Jewish refugees. And they all had visas for Havana. And when they get to Havana, the Cuban president has changed his mind and he won't let them land. So they sail up the coast of Florida and they're sending cables to President Roosevelt saying, can we land in America? And they're so close to Miami that fishing boats are coming out with tourists to snap pictures of them because they have become a tourist attraction. So they get a cable from Roosevelt saying, you can't land. In effect, we have enough Jews. And they're sent back to Germany. And when I heard this story, which I came upon at the Holocaust Museum when I was researching my last book, I remember thinking, I am going to write about this. I'm going to put a fictional character on the St. Louis, which I do.
So you have some experience now with historical fiction. How do you manage that marriage of fact and fiction?
It's interesting, and I think it's because I came from this background of travel writing and memoir writing and being a nonfiction writer first, it allowed me to move into fiction. I love the framework of having something real to write about, like real events, to do my fiction around. I think if I was only working fictionally and I had nothing to work with, I didn't have these real events, it would almost be paralyzing. It's almost like I have to make up too much. But I love this idea that I'm working with something factual and I can put a fictional character and move that character in and among the real events and see how can I use what really happened to move my fictional characters through their emotional journeys. I love that, and I love the skills that I've learned both writing memoir and travel to sort of fill out my fiction.
Are there any tricky intersections? So, for example, if a fictional character is speaking with someone who really lived or is receiving a cable from President Roosevelt that they might really have received, how do you deal with that part of it?
When you write historical fiction, you are actually allowed to do whatever you want. But I feel like you have this obligation to stay as close to reality as possible. I mean, I'm a big reader of historical fiction. And I feel cheated if I feel like the writer's taken too many liberties. So I try to do the research so that I stay as close to the facts as possible. It's interesting because sometimes you feel like, oh my God, there's this sort of karmic fate. I need to move my character this way. And then this really happened with these people. And I try to get as many original sources. And I'll see something like someone said this or did this or this character tried to commit suicide on the ship. And that works perfectly for what happened with my character. And so it sometimes will dovetail perfectly. And you're thinking, I was meant to be. My character was supposed to be on the St. Louis. It's kind of great when that happens.
What are the particular challenges to this genre?
I think it's sometimes for some people it's research. I hear other writers who love research. They say they go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And they get so caught up in research that they don't write. This is why I think I'm perfect for it, because I hate research. I'd much rather write. So I only do as much research as I need to. Because for me, historical fiction is about the fiction. It's about the story. It's not about the facts, because then people would just read nonfiction. So it was interesting because for, let's say, the part of my book that takes place in Berlin, as Hitler's coming to power, I've never been to Berlin. So for that research, I actually used a timeout guide to, you know, give me the streets and places. But then I used the Christopher Isherwood stories, the stories that became the basis for the play and the movie Cabaret, because they really gave me a flavor of what Berlin was like at that time. It was very decadent and violent. They weren't really sure if the Nazi Party would come into power or the communists. And so those Christopher Isherwood stories gave me a better sense of what Berlin was like at that time than any other research. And that's what I find you really need with historical fiction, to broaden what you'll use for your research. For a lot of Jack, the boy growing up in Manhattan, I used my dad's stories because my dad was a boy a little younger than Jack growing up in Manhattan during World War II. And he would tell me stories about the radio programs he listened to. He told me about he went to school after Pearl Harbor and everybody got a colored ribbon to wear around their necks. And if you had like a blue one, you lived close enough to the school to be allowed to run home if the Germans started to bomb New York, which I thought, well, that's interesting. You'll be dodging those bombs. It's like a flavor and a texture you wouldn't get from a book when someone tells you those stories. And I could steal all of them and I put them in my book.
Do you have a pretty good sense of when you've done enough researching to get that texture in? Or how do you know when you've done enough?
I don't know if you'd really do. Sometimes there's always this nagging fear like, oh my God, there's probably some big, amazing thing that happened and I'm leaving it out. You know, when you work on a book for 7 years, hopefully you've found them all. But sometimes you'll be going along and then one thing will mention something else and you'll go and get it. Like I found this amazing cookbook called Victory Meat Extenders, which was this all about when they rationed meat.
Yeah.
And I found this thing online, and it had truly the most disgusting recipes. And they all had these fabulous names. So, of course, that went in the book. You're kind of hoping that over time you'll stumble on most things, and you just pray you're not missing it. Because sooner or later when your book comes out, someone will email you about the thing you missed.
What about dialogue? Obviously, these people spoke English, but English might have been a bit different then. Do you try to account for that, or how do you approach that?
There's a trick. You're trying to make it so that it sounds like the time, but then, you know, if you watch movies from that time, there's sort of this stylized dialogue of movies from the 40s that if you put it in the book, it would call a lot of attention to itself. So you really don't want to do that because then people will just be saying, this sounds weird, like an old movie. So you kind of have to make your character sound natural so that the dialogue doesn't call attention to itself. Sometimes there are things that are true historically, phrases or whatever, but might sound too modern. And it's almost always these real things that readers will say, that doesn't sound right. And you'll be saying, well, it's historically accurate, but you'll have to take it out. Because if it pulls someone out of the story, it's not worth it. One of the interesting things I found about doing this was all of the anti-Semitism in America during this time in the 40s. I came upon a thing called Camp Siegfried, which was run by the German Bund, and it was out on Long Island. It was basically a Nazi camp, and they ran it almost all the way until Pearl Harbor. They would wear these sort of Nazi uniforms. They would do marching around, Heil Hitler, training camps. And so many of them went on weekends that they would run special trains from Penn Station out to this camp in Long Island. Obviously, I put a character who goes out to Camp Siegfried on weekends in my book, because it really challenges what we think about America and our own perception of ourselves during World War II. I mean, we always thought of ourselves as the good guys. We were on the side of right, but there was a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism in America during World War II. And that was something I wanted to get in this book as well, to have that be part of this. My editor has this, you know, sort of the elevator pitch and the way to describe what it's about. But I always find it so hard to do that because there are so many different interweaving storylines. To me, I think the book is really about the stories we tell ourselves, both individually, because it's about denial, about Jack the boy, how he copes with the grief and the stories he tells himself to cope with that. It's about the stories the Jews in Germany told themselves as Hitler was coming to power, because it was a lot about a slow boil for them. They lost their rights one by one. Like, they couldn't walk on certain streets, and then they couldn't go to doctors, and then they couldn't go to theaters or libraries. But I think that it came so slowly, people would say, well, it will be okay. We'll be okay. And then I think it's also the stories America told itself, that we were the good guys. There was no anti-Semitism here. And I think it's fascinating because humans were the only beings who tell ourselves stories. And we do it for both ill and as a coping mechanism, but I think there's a redemptive power in stories. And for me, that's really what A Master Plan for Rescue is about. It's about the power of stories, of storytelling, and how we use it in our lives. In the book, both Jack and Jacob tell themselves stories in order to attempt this rescue. And their goal for doing this rescue is that they believe they will gain what they have lost, the people that they have lost. What I find so interesting about this is that they attempt something and they do something heroic, but what causes them to do it is kind of a delusional thinking. It's the stories that they're telling themselves they will accomplish by this heroic act, and they can't. They can't ever really accomplish what they want to do. They have told themselves these stories to help them cope with their grief. But out of those stories comes an amazingly heroic act that they do. And I can't be more specific because I would be spoiler alert. But I love this idea that you can do something heroic and you will gain some kind of redemption out of your heroic act, even if you don't get what you actually wanted.
That's really lovely. Was there a specific incident in your own life that inspired you to think about redemption this way?
I wasn't sure it was about redemption, but about the idea of that kind of magical thinking was the second inspiration for the book, which was when I started this book, my own son was 12. And when boys are 12, I think they stand equally in the realms of childhood and adulthood. They are amazing the way that they think, because one minute they are telling you how to fix your computer, and the next minute they're saying, would you buy me those Buzz Lightyear sheets because I'm going to summer camp? And their imaginative worlds are so rich. I remember thinking, okay, this is the other character I have to have. I have to write a 12-year-old boy. I need to write that imaginative world. And that's when I thought, okay, how would a 12-year-old boy cope with the loss of the most important person to him? How would he deal with a grief that is that big, using that imagination? And that's when I started to think about this storytelling world. And how would you build a world around it? How would you deny that loss? What would you do to overcome that? And that's when I started to get that magical thinking world. So that was sort of the inspiration for that and for Jack the character and for this beginning of magical thinking and beginning to think about stories and the power of stories. And I think every fiction writer likes to believe that stories are super powerful, because that's what we do all day, is make things up and write them down.
Your book before this was Mary, about Mary Lincoln, Abe Lincoln's wife. And I'm wondering, was it very different to write this most recent book with so many male characters and get into their heads? Was it more difficult than writing Mary?
Yes, that's probably why it took so long. And I don't think I could have attempted it unless I was the mother of a son, because I always said I would never write a male point of view character, because I just couldn't get into that head. And it took a long time for me to find the voice for this. And I think the key to it was when I finally realized that I could write it in retrospect, because for a long time I was really writing Jack as a 12-year-old. And then one day I thought, well, he doesn't always have to be 12. He could be telling this from a future point in retrospect. And I thought, oh, my God, that solves so many problems.
It sounds like it would be harder. It would be way more complicated. How did it solve problems?
Well, it's very hard for a 12-year-old to have the emotional maturity to deal with a lot of the issues she was dealing with. And so at some point, older Jack can come and explain this now.
Wow.
And suddenly older Jack had solved a lot of, you know, narrative problems for me. When I got to the Jacob character, the older character, his section was much easier to write because he was a grown-up. So that part came much smoother. That was simpler. And people have asked me, because I'm not Jewish myself, and they can say, how could you write so convincingly as this Jewish man? And I said, I really don't know. But I think writing is a form of method acting. You sort of inhabit these characters. You feel all their emotions in your body, and then you figure out how to put it on the page.
Were there any other serendipitous surprises in addition to the fact that you got to see things differently by looking at Jack as an older character? Were there other things like that that came up?
I never meant Jacob to be quite as big a character, and it really changed the book when I did let him. I knew he would be on the St. Louis, but one day I started to think, I need to figure out his backstory, what happens before he gets on that boat. And I just started to write small things about it. I didn't realize that he would have this whole love story, which is really the key to him. And I wrote small parts of it. And then I gave it to some people to read, and they were like, you need to write way more of this. And I thought, okay. And it just exploded. In a couple of months, it was one of those. I hate when writers say it wrote itself, because nothing writes itself, really. You're really pushing all of it out. But it really was the easiest part of the book to write. And I needed that, because he needs to have that tragic love story in Berlin before he gets on that boat. It was more important than the part, even I think, on the St. Louis. That was an amazing thing. It was like that part of the story was waiting to be told.
Is that typical for you when you're writing, that you don't sketch everything out and outline it ahead of time, that in some cases at least you just need to start writing and see what writes itself? Haha.
No, I'm super anal. I outline everything, and it was odd for that to have happened. It should happen more, because that was the section of the book I edited the least. It came out the closest to what's in the finished book. It's very unusual. I had a huge amount of backstory for Jack's father, 80 pages of his backstory in Ireland and the Irish Revolution. That did not make it into the book. Everybody seemed to have problems with that section. My writing group, different editors who were considering buying the book, my eventual editor who did buy the book. I tried very hard to keep that section. It was one of my darlings. And then finally, I thought, if I was making a movie of this book, I would cut this. So I cut it. It became the beginning of a new book. Yeah. And I think what happened was, I think I worked on Master Plan for so long that I had started a new novel. And it just found its way in there. And so when I took it out, I put another character in it, and it just took off as another book.
Is that your next book then?
Yeah, it is definitely. I really wanted to write this setting and this time period.
It's like, I think it's Hemingway who said at the end of each day he would write something that led him into the next day's work. You did it at the end of a novel.
Yeah, and I think it's a good idea, because when you have a new book come out, you're very obsessive and you're sending your baby into the world. You can get too consumed with that. And I think it's very smart to start a new book right away if you can, if you have an idea. It keeps you very grounded and centered, and you're not sitting there worrying about, is anyone reading my book? I don't know, because you have no idea how your book is doing when it comes out, you know, until people start to email you and tweet back to you and that kind of thing. It's not like you're walking around seeing people read it all the time. So it's nice to move on to another book.
Any other projects in the works right now?
So I'm hoping to get back to some travel writing, because that's always fun and it's a great break now that I'm mostly done with book tour. You know, when you're working on a new book and it's still in your head and it's not on the page, it's like you're walking on eggshells, because it's like you're afraid it might vanish. But when it exists as a tangible thing in the world, you can kind of take a breath and relax, do my travel writing, and then start editing it and working on the second draft.
Well, so how does that work? You've got that project you're working on. You've got the other book that's in your head. You've got the travel writing that you're doing. Then you've got whatever book you're marketing at the time. That's a whole lot to balance. How does that work? And how does the marketing part of it work?
Well, book promotion, it's different. I mean, my last book was 9 years ago. It's changed entirely.
Really?
Since then. Yes. Because most of it is social media now. Uh-huh. Before, it was all tour. and I toured all over, which was exhausting. Now it's mostly local tour, so you do that. And then my publicist has me writing essays and things for blogs. You do podcast interviews. If you're lucky, and I'm with Riverhead, and they're great. They did a lot of glossy magazine stuff and did get a lot of nice press. They do a lot of social media stuff for me. So they're doing a lot of cool Instagramming things. That's where a lot of the marketing is now. It's social media. Most books now are sold on peer-to-peer reviews. So you want word of mouth, you want Goodreads. They do a lot of Goodreads giveaways. It's a very different landscape from 9 years ago when my last book came out. And I'm going to guess it's going to constantly change, but social media has made a huge difference in book marketing, which I think is better because book tour was grueling and kind of awful, really. It only sounds glamorous.
Let's talk a little about your writing process.
I discovered this new thing 6 months ago, which has really helped me with this first draft. I was thinking, you know, your stories come from the same place your dreams come from, which sounds very woo-woo, but I think it's true. So I decided to try this out. I have this desk in my bedroom, and I put my computer there at night, and I think about, what do I have to write next? I think about it at night. When I wake up in the morning, I don't think about what I have to do in the day. I don't let any other story come into my head. I think about the novel. I just get a cup of coffee because I really can't do anything without coffee. And I go to the computer, and for maybe between 10 and 20 minutes, I free write. I won't stop. I won't edit. I just free write into what I have to write next on that novel. And it's been remarkable. I do it 7 days a week, and I just push the story forward. And then I'll go, you know, have breakfast, and I'll think about other things, read the paper online. And it's amazing. This is why I think I've moved so fast through this new book, because I'm connected with it every day. Even on days I don't write, I've moved that story forward, and it's in my head, and I've touched that story world. And usually when I do go to write, I'm maybe 2,000 to 5,000 words behind there, you know, moving the story, but I see where I'm going, and I've got something to work with. I've got all this free write stuff. I don't always use the stuff that I've written, but it's a framework, and I've got a sense of where the story's moving forward. I always know before I begin a project what my character wants and what my character needs to learn over the course of the book. Those are the two things I have in my mind. Other things will change, and I tend to outline sections of the book. I'll have the first section outlined, and I'll write all that, then I'll do the second section.
Do you write in order?
Yeah, I write in order. Even if I think that the book might not end up in order, I do. Like with the Mary Lincoln book, that book is out of order, you know, because she's in the lunatic asylum and then she's going back and writing her life. So that book is all chopped up because she's 57 years old in the lunatic asylum. And then she goes back to when she's 6 years old and we go back and forth. And I thought I was going to write it that way. And then I realized I couldn't write her at 57 because I didn't know her at 57. I had to set that aside and I had to start writing it in order. So I had to start writing her from when she was 6 and writing her straight through until she was 57. And then I understood who she was. And then I wrote all her scenes in the lunatic asylum. And then I chopped it up the way it eventually ended up to edit it.
Interesting.
Yeah, but I had to learn it. 3 years ago, almost 4 now, I founded Lit Camp, which is a writer's conference. And a number of people here this year and last year at the Book Passage Travel Conference are Lit Campers. So it's over a weekend. We only take 40 people. And last year we had 240 people apply.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So we take writers of fiction, creative nonfiction, and memoir. And we held it at Mayacamas Ranch in Calistoga, which is a fantastic property. They do yoga retreats there. And we take over the whole property. It's from a Thursday afternoon to Sunday. We make it so that people can fit it into their lives. We keep it as cheap as possible. And now we have scholarships, full scholarships for people. It's workshops in the morning, panels in the afternoon. And now we have created what we call writers in residence. Last year we had Adam Johnson, who won the Pulitzer Prize 2 years ago. And he will probably be coming for 2016 to do that as well. He came up just the whole time. And then he was there for people to talk to and then did like a 2-hour lecture on one of the days. We fly in agents and editors from New York to be part of our workshop staff and also to be on our panels. It's amazing. It's an amazing conference. Just this past year, my agent, Ellen Levine, who's one of the major agents in New York, I mean, she represents Marilyn Robinson and, you know, tons of amazing people. She signed one of our lit campers.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, it's great. We have another lit camper who's got a two-book deal with FSG. So people are now coming out of lit camp, even though we're only, this will be our fourth year. They're coming out and getting really good book deals. The website is litcampwriters.org. And in addition to the conference now, we do other things. Because we can only take 40 people, we thought, you know, we're getting all these amazing writers. What else can we do for them? So we wanted to create a lot of community for emerging writers. So we do a thing called the Lit Camp Writing and Drinking Club in San Francisco.
Sounds perfect.
Yes. Scholar Match, which is part of Dave Eggers 826, they have an office on Valencia Street. They give it to us once a month on a Sunday. And we gather there and write for 2 hours on a Sunday afternoon, just in community, all of us silent writing. And then at 5 o'clock, everyone brings wine or beer and we just socialize for an hour. Also, every other month, we do a thing called the Basement Reading Series. Sports Basement on Bryant Street gives us space. They have a really great space there. And we will take five emerging writers who will get to read on stage with two published authors. And we get 70 to 100 people because we give away free beer. And we charge admission. And some of that money we raise goes to Scholar Match and also to fund our scholarships for Lit Camp. All of that information people can find out about on our website and by subscribing to our newsletter.
I've been talking with Janice Cook Newman, author of A Master Plan for Rescue. We're at Book Passage Travel Writers Conference in Corte Madera, California.
I'm Janice Cook Newman.
Thanks, Janice.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort Maui at Wailea invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show, Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a weekly featured podcast on NPR.org, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. Our San Francisco-based associate producer is Molly Blaisdell, covering the San Francisco Bay Area, the island of Maui, and the South Pacific. Our Wisconsin-based associate producer is Julie Henning.